The talk you're about to hear is by Zen teacher Sensei Amala Wrightson.
Today is the 6th of August 2019, Hiroshima Day. And we're going to take up two very short stories from The Hidden Lamp. This is this great compendium of stories about women in Buddhism. And these two stories come from two important figures of the 20th century. The first one is called Deepa Ma's Fearless Daughters, and the other one is called Anne Aitken's Get On and Go. And just a little bit before we get to the stories themselves, a little bit about these two women. Deepa Ma was born into an Indian Buddhist family. Her dates are 1911 to 1989. She married when she was just 12 years old and moved to Burma. And after her husband and her youngest child died, she was grief-stricken, but eventually found her way to practicing with a Burmese teacher, Anagarika Munindra. And she had a powerful awakening experience when she was 53. She moved to Calcutta in 1968, and she taught out of her tiny apartment. I think it was a one-room apartment. And twice she came to America in the 80s, 1980 and 1984, to teach at IMS, Insight Meditation Society, on the East Coast. And then the other person here is Anne Aitken. Anne Aitken, her dates, actually she was born the same year as Deepa Ma in 1911, and she lived to 1994. She co-founded Kokoan Zendo in Hawaii in 1959 with her husband, Zen teacher Robert Aitken, and then they later co-founded the Maui Zendo and established the Diamond Sangha, one of the significant Zen lineages of the West and very closely related to our own. She studied with Soen Nakagawa Roshi, Yasutani Roshi, and Yamada Roshi. And she was never formally a teacher, but she was a great inspiration and support to generations of Zen students in the Diamond Sangha, and particularly to women. So, as I said, these two stories are quite brief, but they sort of will hopefully set some themes for this talk. And in this book, each chapter comes in three parts. There's a story, some of them more koan-like, some of them less. These two aren't so much like koans. And then there's a reflection from a woman teacher, and then there are some little questions posed at the end by the editors of the book that aim to kind of draw out various aspects of the stories. And here's our first one, which has to do with Deepa Ma. Deepa Ma was on an aeroplane with a woman student. It was very turbulent, and the woman screamed. Deepa Ma was sitting across the aisle and took her hand and held it. Then she whispered, "The daughters of the Buddha are fearless." So that's the that's our story. And the person giving the reflection on this particular story is Amita Schmidt. Just a little bit about her. She is the author of a book, actually one that we've used in Taisho before, about Dipa Ma, the life and legacy of a Buddhist master. Amita is a psychotherapist in Hawaii and specializes in trauma and anxiety. And she also leads retreats in Vipassana and both the Vipassana and the Advaita tradition. So she says, makes some comments about this story. She says, Dipa Ma is emphasizing the fearlessness needed on this path of the Dharma. To know the truth, one must be fearless no matter what is happening. Whether there is aeroplane turbulence or physical injury, can you have a heart and mind that are unshakable? Waking up is not a part-time job for the faint-hearted. It is the intention to meet every moment continually without flinching. As a daughter of the Buddha, you are an example to all beings of the willingness to face what is right now without fear or argument. Whether you're a daughter or a son of the Buddha, this is really what we're called to do as practitioners, to be able to keep an even keel through whatever turbulence we encounter in our lives. And this little story jumped out at me in the context of this discussions we've been having, the study we've been doing on the climate crisis. We really have this sense that we're entering into a time of great uncertainty, not only for the whole of the human race, but for all sentient beings. Time of turbulence, and real. Large-scale change. So Komitant has put it in terms of moving from the stability of the Holocene archaeological period into the turbulence and the instability of the Anthropocene, when we're now experiencing, we can say, the ripening of our karma as human beings in terms of how we've been treating our earth. Amita Schmidt goes on to tell a story of her own. A few months ago, I had a lesson in being a fearless daughter of the Buddha. On a balmy, sunny morning, I decided to go out for a solo swim in the ocean in Hawaii, where I live. There were some colorful fish where I was swimming, and I became preoccupied with following some of them. Unfortunately, I didn't notice until it was too late that I had drifted out with an ocean current about a mile from the shore. To make matters worse, a strong wind suddenly arose, and as I tried to swim to shore, the whitecaps pushed me back for every stroke I took. When I realized I was a long way out, alone, in shark territory, and unable to make much progress against the wind, I had a moment of panic. It was similar to the scream of Dipa Ma's student on the aeroplane. But then my Dharma practice kicked in. It was as if the power of my intention from years of practice came forward on its own to help. It labeled the feeling. This is panic. It's just panic. Panic is not going to help you. Don't believe panic. Then my daughter of the Buddha mind said, just do what you can do. Stay focused on right now, one thing at a time. Start with one kick and one arm movement at a time. You can do that. Don't worry about anything else. I put a concentrated focus on the body and stayed out of the mind. I paid attention to the movement of my arms in the swimming motion, one breath at a time, and the kicking of my legs. I noticed that despite the wind, I was able to move a tiny bit forward with each stroke. I focused on the small amount of forward motion rather than the feeling of being pushed back. A spontaneous resolve arose to not give up, no matter how long it took. This predictive dharma of the present moment, along with the resolve of the Buddha, eventually brought me back, exhausted, to shore. So I think we can take quite a bit from this description. We can see what she's pointing at, that it's easy to get into a panic about what's going on in the world, and we can come in that panic, that fear, anxiety, we can get gripped, we can become gripped by assumptions about how things are going to turn out. We can feel very powerless. Another way sometimes that people will deal with that sense of powerlessness or vulnerability will be looking for someone else to blame. Or we can take refuge in very strong opinions about what's right and what's wrong, which we can then cling to, and give us some sense of some certainty. And that seeking for certainty, for what is clearly right and wrong, can even lead to a kind of extremism in us, extreme thinking, extreme emotions. But if more than ever, what's really needed as we face uncertain times, unstable times, is a steady mind that can be open to what is happening, that can be honest about what's going on, but at the same time not get easily phased, thrown off balance. She says, whether we are experiencing a bumpy flight, a difficult ocean swim, or a turbulent life, our practice is the same. We are given the chance to meet this moment with openness and fearlessness. It doesn't matter how long it takes or how much the wind pushes us back. If there is a willingness not to give up and a resolve to keep taking that one next step, then it is inevitable that each one of us will find lasting freedom. To keep taking those small steps. Our other little story, maybe say it has a related theme, even shorter than the first one. Anne Aitken was a student of Master Yamada Koen. One day he asked her, "What do you think of death?" She replied, "Why, it's like when a bus stops before you, you get on and go." It's like a bus stops. When a bus stops before you, you get on and go. The thing about death is that all our reading, our theories, our beliefs, all of that, in the face of death, are just fall away. Are just don't have any kind of purchase. Because we can't know what is going to unfold in our death. We don't know where we're going. That's why this image of the bus is so great. The bus, you're standing there at the side of the road, the bus comes up and you get on and go. You don't know where you're going. We could take this story also to be a story for how we live, not just how we die. We really don't, in many ways, know where life is taking us. How things will turn out, we don't know. We can look at all the evidence around climate change and make predictions, but until it actually happens, that's what they are, just predictions. I used to have, for quite a few years, a recurring dream that I was on a bus going somewhere, but when I got to my stop, the bus didn't stop but kept going, and I couldn't get off. And my guess is that this dream was picturing my own fear of life. Longing maybe to be able to control where things were taking me. This just next part of the Teisho, I wanted to sort of take up a case study that relates to our climate change discussions, and particularly to our declaration of a climate emergency that the trustees made recently, after we just talked about it as a Sangha and agreed that it was something we wanted to do. And some time around that declaration, I had a talk with Bhante Yasala. Some of you know as She's the abbess of a monastery up in Kerikeri. She's also known as Inchelsanim. She's been here, I don't know, maybe 20 years, but was born and grew up in Korea and trained in Korean Son monasteries. And Bhante Yasala suggested that our Sangha might like to participate in a pilgrimage that she's organizing to Bodh Gaya in early February next year. And she suggested that we could go with members of our sangha could go with members of her sangha to stay in a temple that she has a connection to in Bodh Gaya, and then from there go on a tour in a bus around the other main Buddhist pilgrimage sites, and Rich and I were both interested in this because it's something that for a long time we've wanted to do. We wanted to make that pilgrimage to India, and so I wrote up a little note to put in the Friday email, but then realized that I was feeling really ambivalent about it, because in the light of having made a climate emergency declaration, how did making a big plane trip sort of square with that? And so it seemed like a perfect way to explore the meaning of having made the declaration, which is one of the things that's on the agenda for the next trust meeting, since they've got these instructions from the Sangha to pursue this and to keep going and making it something real and solid within our Sangha. For maybe 10 years or so, I haven't been able to bring myself to take planes for holidays, to fly somewhere for a holiday. And this really came about after I'd been to both Vanuatu and Rarotonga and seen the coral reefs in both those places. And in Vanuatu, also seen an area of coral which had been through a bleaching event, in other words, a large die-off of the coral because of a particularly warm year that had occurred in this in Tana, this island that we were on, some years before, one of the hottest years on record at that point. And this area is particularly warm because it's warmed also by the volcanic activity that's right there, where the beach is. So anyway, I'd seen this, and I realized that these beautiful coral reefs were being threatened because of rising global temperatures, and not to mention ocean acidification, and that air travel contributed to those rising temperatures. And it seemed a kind of contradiction to be going and seeing these beautiful, stunningly beautiful coral reefs and the fish life in them, but at the same time contributing to their destruction. So it hasn't stopped me going flying for other reasons, but it seemed one area where which was pretty easy to just not go fly to holidays anymore. Now, how does the pilgrimage relate to that? That was a question that came up. So it's you could say it's more than a holiday, but could certainly be described as kind of discretionary travel. It's not something that absolutely necessary. So it seemed important to really look into the effects of flying and consider how that fits with going on pilgrimage. Whether it's a contradiction of the whole purpose of going on pilgrimage, which is to do more than go and see sights, but really to be able to be to go on some kind of a spiritual journey. So since I had that hesitation of not being ready to kind of announce this to the Sangha, and it seemed to me it'd be a good idea to take along to the trustees for them to discuss, but I also wanted just to bring it up in Taisho as well. And in the process of looking into it, really what I came to was that it's not a black and white, completely black and white thing. You can't say with absolute certainty that it's wrong to go or that it's right to go to fly. You can look into it. And just as I was doing that, in fact, somebody posted something on our Dharma Rain Facebook page, which set out the most effective individual steps to tackle climate change. And among them was flying less. And the article, this appeared in phys.org, which is like a physics website that looks into climate issues, among other things. The four actions that most substantially decrease an individual's carbon footprint are eating a plant-based diet, avoiding air travel, living car-free, and having smaller families. So it was right up in the top of the list there. Also around this last week or so, I saw the news about Greta Thunberg is going to catch a yacht from Europe to America to go to a conference, and she has actually helped been part of generating a new word in Swedish, which translates into English as flight shame. And in Sweden, the amount of train travel has gone up considerably. And it is inspiring to see her example and her willingness to undergo hardship, probably seasickness, certainly all kinds of weather and ups and downs, turbulence, we could say, to cross from Europe to America for this this conference. And her doing so gives her work a kind of moral force. It is inspiring and it has weight to it. So this is one factor to consider. Just sort of by chance, in looking into this article about these four top individuals' best steps for tackling one's personal emissions, right next to it, and this was probably actually intended by the editors of this site, there was another article from some time ago, headed up, emphasizing individual solutions to big issues can reduce support for government efforts. And this other article went into some research which has been done about in Japan by a researcher called Seth Werfel. And he did this research following the shutdown of the Fukushima power plant. And after that, the Japanese government initiated a campaign to get people to save electricity in order to lower demand on the remaining network, I guess, in Japan. And what he found was that the more people said they curbed their energy use on their own, the less they supported government actions, such as putting a tax on carbon emissions. And he thought this was somewhat counterintuitive, because you would expect the people who are making the personal sacrifices would be the ones who would also support government action. But in fact, what he seemed, the survey seemed to be saying, was that when people took the survey, they felt like they were doing a lot and that the government shouldn't make them do more. And we know that a lot of the change that's needed in relation to climate change, the individual actions are not sufficient. And if we focus too much on just individual people changing their actions, then although that person, the person who's taken that step of reducing their own emissions, lowers their personal emissions, it doesn't necessarily mean that overall emissions will be much changed at all. The plane still flies, and the carbon emissions are divided up by the people on the plane. They're just all responsible for a bit more, the ones who actually do fly. So most people agree that to get major reductions in the amount of flying that happens, prices have to rise significantly, and that takes collective action at government level. We also talked in one of our sessions, the earlier sessions when we kicked off this program of looking into climate change, that the commercial aviation industry is quite a small proportion of global emissions, just 2.5%. Whereas the aviation associated with the military is enormous. I think it was Celestina who mentioned in her talk that 10 minutes of a B-52 is equal to about a year's average car use for a year. So it's huge amounts of emissions that aren't even accounted for. And so some kind of work on militarization is desperately needed here. And it's possible you could say that too much emphasis on our own individual actions could mean that's all we do, and that the collective action may be neglected. Another piece of research in the same vein was people feeling after going to church tipping less, because assuming that because they feel more virtuous and don't feel like they have to reach out to others in the same way. Another factor that I think is an important one here is if we do, and this relates to the feeling, the kind of feeling virtuous thing, if we do something just because we think we should, then there may eventually be a kind of hidden backlash of some kind. Greta Thunberg actually said, in commenting on her decision to go by boat across the Atlantic, she said, "I don't say people shouldn't fly. It should just be easier to be zero carbon." So to see that all our structures, the way we're set up the way things are run, there's it makes it hard for people to make individual choices that are going to be helpful for the climate change. And so we may need to be strategic to can't necessarily do everything at all at once, so we have to kind of choose where we can be most effective, and perhaps not be so extreme in trying to be pure in a world where it's in so many ways we're compromised. A little bit of from an interview that done by Professor Jim Bendel. Some of you may know him. He runs a kind of movement called Deep Adaptation. And in this post that he made just recently, he's talking to a climate scientist from Lund University, Dr. Wolfgang Knorr. And this is somebody who'd been working in the climate change field for decades, and he was wanting to discuss with Jim Bendel how he could, and other scientists like him, could get the word out about what's happening right now in terms of impacts on nature, and have be more effective than the science world has been up to now. And Jim Bendel asks him the question, what do you think scientists could learn from activists like Extinction Rebellion? In what ways might you and they get involved? And he replies, until very recently, I thought that no one is taking the problem of climate change seriously. There are such endless high risk, possibly low probability, but we don't know, impacts. The problem needs a response of colossal proportions. With the new generation of climate protesters like Extinction Rebellion, that has changed. What I have realized only recently is that there is nothing much you can do at the individual personal level, like saving energy, flying less, and so on. The machinery of industrial society will always make sure your efforts are in vain. What is needed is action at the political and the decision-making level. This is something I have learned from these activists. I'm not an activist by nature, so I am reluctant to make that step, but I believe it is necessary. My impression is that this attitude that I describe for myself here is quite common among scientists, and I think also common among meditators. I think most of us are probably temperamentally fairly introverted, and it may not come naturally to us to get active in the way that members of Extinction Rebellion are. He says, what is happening now is that Extinction Rebellion and similar protest movements increasingly seize the public discourse on climate change and leave much of the scientific community behind, in particular the IPCC. And that is a good thing, because we need to move from the current paradigm. This should answer your second question, moving the public discourse from the problem identification mode to problem confrontation mode. We need a sober, grown-up look at all the risks climate change entails. No doomsaying, no preaching, no exaggeration in order to convince others, but also no shying away from speaking out things that are painful. And to find that middle ground is exactly what a collaboration between climate scientists and the new protest movement could achieve. So brings us back to how to our title of fearlessness and faith. Now, two stories. Having the courage to really face up to what is going on, and also to have courage to look at our own attachments and our own avoidance of the issues. One of the things in struggling with this issue over the flying, when is also wanting to go to India, having wanted to do this for a long time, it wasn't so much going to India or not that came up for me, though that was there too, but realizing that to give up flying was to give up an idea about being able to travel, and having to recognize that I might not have the same freedom as my parents had in their retirement to travel, that I wouldn't be able to bring myself to travel in the way that they did in their in the younger part of their retirement. And it's these kinds of maybe unconscious expectations that we have that it's so important that we look at them and realize the way that we cling to a certain idea about how we should live, what kind of life we should have, of ease and comfort and freedom of movement. And returning to our second story, the one about Anne Aitken and the death, and getting the bus coming and just getting on and going. To find the faith to be okay with not knowing where this bus is going, and being having the willingness just to get on and go, which is really having the faith in our own ability to face whatever needs to be faced as this crisis unfolds, and to do what needs to be done. To find our own calling in the midst of this issue. We can't do everything, but each of us can do something, and to take those small steps or those small strokes of the swimmer, swimming against the current. And just to finish off with a little bit from an article by Roshi Sunyana Grafe, one of my teacher's Dharma sisters, teacher in Vermont. And she starts this article, which is on ecology and Zen, with a quote from Zen Master Dogen. And this is from the Mountains and Rivers Sutra that we're going to be looking at, not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. So Master Dogen says, "If you yourself, who are the valley streams and mountains, cannot develop the power which illuminates the true reality of the mountains and valley streams, who else is going to be able to convince you that you and the streams and mountains are one and the same?" She says, perhaps it is part of being human to question who and what we are. Unfortunately, because we rely almost exclusively on our senses, the harder we look, the more we misinterpret what we see. We believe on the one hand that we are an insignificant dot in the universe, separate from all other humans, much less the natural world. But we also believe that we are the most highly evolved organism in creation, entitled to use whatever we can grasp for our own ends. Both of these statements are untrue. We're not completely insignificant dots in a vast and unfriendly universe. And nor are we the pinnacle of evolution, entitled to use whatever we like for of the world's resources, as it says in Genesis. The Buddhist view is a different one completely. In fact, Sunyana Roshi goes on to say, in terms of their psycho-spiritual development, people stand about midway between Buddhas and amoebas. This is something that Roshi Kaplow used to say, and it's very liberating in a way to realize that we human beings are, most of us, about halfway along the journey to Buddhahood, halfway between Buddhas and amoebas. So that's from the relative point of view, that's where we are in our development. But on the course, from the absolute point of view, as she also says, people, Buddhas, amoebas, dogs, streams and mountains are one and the same. So across all of the surface of this planet, we're all one, equal. Not only spatially either, we can think also in terms of time. Robert McFarlane, who wrote Underland, says, to see ourselves as a web of gift, inheritance and legacy, stretching over millions of years past and millions to come, bringing us to consider what we are leaving behind for the epoch and beings that will follow us. And maybe this view, this way of thinking of ourselves as having received all these gifts from the past, say from our human and non-human tūpuna, and how we're going to pass those gifts on to those who come after us. Mokupuna. If we look at it from this big perspective, how we act and choices we make, it may become clearer what is the right thing for us to do right now, how to respond, to fly or not to fly, what we eat, how we get around. Well, I think we'll have a little bit more material, but we've run out of time, so we'll just stop there and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow
gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.
The teaching you have received is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of this podcast service or learn more about practice opportunities at the Auckland Zen Centre, please visit www.aucklandzen.org.nz.